So, welcome back. So, my intention is to do a little bit of a recap from yesterday. And I want to, for those of you who were here yesterday, thank you for tolerating such a fire hose experience. There was way too much information to compress into time, but I think what it allowed us to do is to have a little more relaxed opportunity to spend some time together today. My intention today is to frame some things for you to pose some barriers of reform in policing, and to also propose some general ideas for your consideration of how the faith community may play a role. I will tell you this, I'm very careful about using words like should and need. And when I train police officers, I don't tell them you need to. I don't tell them you need to meditate. Because frankly, I am not qualified. I am not a deity. I don't know what they need to do. I do know that the science tells us, the research tells us, intuition tells us that it's a good idea. But I don't know what frequency or what, you know, all of these details. We all have to find our own path, okay? And that's really, really important. There are a few things that I am perhaps dogmatic about. But my intention here is not to be dogmatic, not to offer you a prescription for how the faith community ought to respond. I do think, however, having said that, that it strikes me that the majority of the population that comes to Holden Village has power. And where you come from, whether it's economic power, social power, or both, or knowledge power, quite frankly, and maybe that's the most important thing, right? You hold power in some way to participate in some way. And that's my hope and my offering to you, my invitation to you, is to simply explore what those opportunities are for you to participate. Not only in reform and policing, and with a little R even, but really in democracy. Because that's ultimately what this is about for me. The reason that I do this very difficult work, at frankly, a pretty significant professional and sometimes personal cost, is because of my commitment to democracy. I raised my hand as a 19-year-old kid and swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I took that oath seriously. My father fought in war. My brother gave his life for this country. And I take this notion of the flag of democracy incredibly seriously. I take this notion of civil rights very seriously. And I will tell you that sometimes I may sound like I'm anti-police. I am not. I do this work for the men and women who are brave enough to step into an arena that I would venture to say none of you understand. An arena with dark shadows, with violence, with incredible suffering, that all of you meet in some way or another, for sure, okay? But we meet it in a different way, okay? And I'm not here to create martyrdom. I'm simply here to offer some insight and some conversation and maybe a little bit of a push, maybe a little bit of a challenge.
Would you include hate with that?
Hate?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand.
I guess I just understand a policeman going into a setting facing hatred.
Oh, absolutely, and we'll talk about that. The vilification that's occurring in the political discussions, just generally, is inhumane and it's insanity. And what's happening is communities are vilifying police officers, and our response is in kind. Our response is in kind, and we have guns, people. I mean, you know, I hate to say it like that. We're more skilled at violence, generally speaking, not always. And so when it becomes simply a confrontation of emotion and irrational thinking, violence will prevail. And we're better at it, right? That sounds terrible, but let's just speak the truth here. So let's kind of get grounded a bit and come back to, this is a photo from 2013. Those are tennis shoes, you figured that out. Those are unidentified alive, but yet bodies of police officers that are sitting in a circle in a third story of a hospital in Hillsboro, Oregon that it was unfinished. They just had some extra space. We threw down some old worn carpet and we created a meditation studio. And this was the first foray into teaching meditation to police officers in the United States. Okay? Now let me tell you how it happened. So for years, I'd been battling my own administration as a police lieutenant, trying to get approval to run a pilot meditation training, a training that I helped co-create with a really wonderful mentor and meditation teacher named Brant Rogers, who is a phenomenal leader in this arena. And I remember going to my chief of police, and well, actually, 2010, short story, 2010, we had the curriculum ready to go. And I went to my chief of police at the time. It was a female chief named Lila Ashenbrenner, and her and her deputy chief were actually pretty receptive. Okay, all right, we can do this. And I went on 2 weeks of annual military leave with the U.S. Coast Guard, and while I was gone, interestingly enough, this thing called Deepwater Horizon happened. And so I returned about 3.5 months later to a new chief of police. That happens, right? So there's this new guy who doesn't know me from anyone else, right? And he gets a letter from Admiral Allen in the Coast Guard, basically saying, "Hey, you know, we really appreciate Rich's awesome work. I worked for the Admiral in D.C. and basically it was a really nice accolade, right?" And he gets this letter, and like any chief of police who's a cynical asshole, looks at it and says, and most of them are, by the way, he looks at it, and in his mind, he's like, "Who's this Lieutenant Gerling guy? I don't even know him." And you know, so already, because I have, like, I'm doing some cool things back in deep water, and I'm already a threat to his ego. And he was a good human being, still is a good human being, okay? But here's the reality, folks, is that there's so much unregulated ego in this business that there's not enough success to go around, and I have to hold on to as much success as possible. This is how we work in our culture. We are a culture of sharks, okay? And ask cops about this sometime. We'll tell you, okay? So, and then I remember, you know, a week or so into my return, I'm sitting in his office, and I'm just having some conversation with him, right? Because you got to get to know the chief. And I'm a patrol watch commander at the time, and I looked over at his bookshelf, and I see a book of Rumi poetry. And I'm thinking to myself, sweet, Rumi poetry, right? Because it somehow seems mandatory that you learn Rumi poetry when you train in mindfulness. I said to him, "Chief, this is really cool that you've got this book of Rumi poetry in your desk or in your bookshelf." He's like, "Rich, my friend gave me that 10 years ago. I've never even opened it." And I thought, okay, here we go. And so to him, mindfulness was some sort of hippy-dippy, weird-ass, not helpful thing. So we continued for 2.5 more years. And one, I think it was one late Monday night, I get a phone call from one of my sergeants, and he says, "Turn on your radio." And I don't often have my police radio at home. I try to create some barriers, some boundaries. And at that time I had, for some reason, I don't know why I had my police radio at home, and I did. And so I'm on the phone with my standby, grab my radio, turn it on, go, what channel do I go to? Go to this channel. And I'm listening to a response from our SWAT team at a house in a couple cities over. The SWAT team is responding to the home of one of our officers who's in a gunfight with our SWAT team.
Cool.
Okay? His best friend is on the pointy end of the spear with the SWAT team, negotiating in loud voices with his friend who's shooting at him. Right? And that's a dramatic story. It's a real story. He's now spending over 10 years in a state penitentiary in Eastern Oregon for attempted homicide on multiple counts. By some miracle, hundreds of rounds were fired. By some miracle, nobody was killed. A few people were injured. Nobody was killed. It's a domestic violence situation. And there's a lot more details to it, but the point is that was sort of a conflagration event in our agency. The chief promptly resigned. There's all kinds of backstory to that. And I had been working with one of my best mentor is a guy named Ron Louie, who was a chief of police in Hillsborough. Chinese-American, grew up in San Francisco, his father sung opera in the San Francisco Opera. Just totally eclectic, wild man. We all thought he was nuts, and we loved him for it. And incredibly innovative, forward thinker. He was a chief who hired me 22 years ago. And he retired. And since then, we've had a lot of rocky things with the agency. But he came back as interim chief, and he had followed what I was doing with mindfulness training. He calls me on a Monday. It's his first day as interim chief. And he says, "Rich, I'm going to get these people out of your way. Understand it'll cost you your career." Mm. And I said, "Roger that. Let's go." And so within weeks, we had launched our pilot training. Over the course of the next 10 months, we trained 54 police officers in my agency, 8 weeks of mindfulness. And what I found was interesting. With all of the barriers up here at the senior leadership, I had to churn officers away. And there's a reason for that. One, suffering, and two, relationship. I spent years socializing the concept to key people, to SWAT officers, to canine officers, to school resource officers, to trainers, having hours-long conversations about neuroscience, about human performance, about stress and trauma. And even though they all thought I was a wacky weirdo, there was a level of trust that I'd established with them and brought them to the mat. Which gets me to this. Systems change doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. Systems change doesn't even happen in your state legislatures. Systems change happens organically. And in the context of mindfulness, it happens on the mat. It happens in the dojo, where we train warriors. This is where it happens. So what I want to do now is just recap a few things that you've already heard me talk about, but frame them differently. This is an actual photo of LAPD officers taking down a bank robber. Okay? So we have this cycle of predictable outcomes, as I have come to refer to it. Police officers are facing critical incidents. These are just the, you know, sometimes they're the routine critical incidents. Sometimes they're acute. Okay? And I'm not sure in a city like Los Angeles that this just isn't routine right here, what you're seeing. Right? I mean, these are badass warriors here. Okay? Chronic exposure to suffering. This is human suffering externally on the outside of the badge in our community, but it's also suffering that we experience, the suffering that our colleagues experience. Cumulative organizational stress. It's very interesting when we query, scientifically, when we query first responders, we query police officers, what we find is their perception of stress, that they're more stressed about administrative bureaucracies, people like me, the brass, than they are about the felons in the field. Now, if that isn't a symptom of a culture that's completely upside down, I don't know what is. Significant impact on our health and well-being. Public perception and misperception, right? Legal challenges, lawsuits. You're going to get sued. There's all kinds of wacky people out there that just pick up random cops and start suing them and make their lives miserable. Then there's civil rights lawsuits. I've been through a lot of interesting operational stress. Probably the most stressful thing I've experienced is sitting on the stand for 3 days in a civil rights lawsuit. And that was simply just for firing a bully. Culture of apathy. At some point, you're just kind of like, you just don't care anymore. And it's not because you wake up and say, I'm just going to be an apathetic person, I don't care anymore. You just don't have it. And this is predictable, okay? And then fear. You become afraid. Not only do you become afraid because of stress and trauma over time that's not mitigated, you become afraid because you're conditioned to become afraid. We train cops to fear. Not to manage it, but to be reactive with it. Not helpful. Not helpful. As an example, okay, I know Steve's from Minneapolis. Some of my friends here are also from the St. Paul area. Christine Damond, not long ago, called police. Fiance lived in a kind of an upper-class part of Minneapolis. She hears what she thinks is a sexual assault occurring in kind of the alleyway of her condo complex. She calls Minneapolis PD. Minneapolis PD arrives. Two-person car. Car rolls up into the alley, all darked out. She, just being kind of just the citizen who's just, kind of doesn't understand not to approach police car, but still, it's okay to do that. Not the best idea. She approaches the car on the driver's side, startles the officer in the passenger seat, draws his weapon and shoots her.
Yeah.
Kills her. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a fear response. He's being prosecuted for manslaughter and probably some other things, right? So there's not a good ending to that at all, right? Just wanted to point that out. Okay? Now let's move away from the job. Let's move to family pressures. We take stress home, right? There's a recent study that I just love. I love studies that demonstrate, really that prove what we know experientially. There's a study among firefighters that basically studied a firehouse, and then they went to the families and studied the families. So the spouses, the partners, the children. And then they found measurable stress impact on the part of the children and the families. And we need studies like this. It sounds stupid, right? You take stress home, we all know this. But when you're a first responder, you take stress home, you kind of just think it's just, well, you take it home and it's just for you. No, not so much. You take it home and it negatively impacts the health and well-being of your family. And that creates all kinds of problems. We move into maladaptive coping strategies. We talked a little bit about those. And then the propensity for problems on duty. It's not uncommon for police officers who get involved in shootings to begin the end of their career. A good friend of mine named Mark, kind of grew up in policing with him the first 5 years. He went to another agency after about 5 years. And he was on a radio call. Actually, his sergeant, Damon Coates, in Clackamas, Oregon, was on a radio call of a mental health issue. And we call these now behavioral health interventions. It was a behavioral health intervention call, 14-year-old kid named Nick, sitting on a couch in his mom's basement. Just mom's like, I don't know what to do with him. I can't, I need help. Damon Coates goes down to visit with him. And my buddy Mark told me later, he's like, you know, it wasn't my call. I knew the sergeant was there. I knew there was another deputy there. I didn't need to go. But for some reason, I felt like I needed to go. So I went to the radio call. I walked past the deputy who was upstairs talking to mom. I have no idea why I did this. And I went down with Sergeant Coates. And as he arrived, Sergeant Coates is kneeling like this, talking to this kid sitting on the couch. Kid pulls out a handgun and shoots Damon in the head. Mark responded by shooting a 14-year-old kid. Right? Kid survived. Right? Then Mark is providing first aid to his friend who's shot in the head. Traumatized. I mean, later, Mark's lieutenant tells him, you know, Mark, you know how we deal with this? Just go home and drink. Yeah, this is a culture of law enforcement, folks, okay? And Mark, of course, did what he was told. Mark's no longer in law enforcement. I think Mark still has a lot of unresolved trauma as a result of that. Yeah, so problems on duty, but the point about Mark's story is that Mark became a disciplinary problem. Why? Because Mark's, as we say, Mark's a piece of shit, right? Not true. Mark had significant trauma that the organization didn't address and predictably became a disciplinary problem. Had he not quit, he would have been fired for stupid stuff, showing up to work on late, having a bad attitude, right? All those things that are predictable, right? So, and this all feeds into these challenging cycles that continue to perpetuate. And you know, the definition of insanity, keep getting what you keep getting because you keep doing what you keep doing, right? Perhaps worthwhile. So historically, organizations and law enforcement delegate health and well-being to the individual. We hire capable young people and don't tell them the dirty secret that they've just given up 10 years of their life. And then we hope like hell they make it through. And we might send them to a training on, you know, emotional survival in law enforcement. We might give them a book written by somebody who has a few good ideas, but mostly just a bunch of superfluous bullshit, right? And we hope like hell they make it through. It doesn't work. And then we see all these predictable behavioral problems, and now we want a pound of flesh from the individual, which accountability is critical. Don't misunderstand me. But the system's accountability is absent. That's a problem for you to solve, right? Facilitating holistic wellness through science-based, evidence-based strategies is a new concept. And we're struggling to figure out how to do this. It's on our mind, but we're not really paying attention to science, okay? This is a photo of NYPD, by the way. Real, actual photo taken by a police officer, former police officer. So here's just a reminder of some data. Cardiovascular profiles are terrible. Sleep deprivation, obesity, depression, inflammation, all these things, you know, not helpful, right? Scottish psychiatrist, words of wisdom. What we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little we can do to change. Until we notice how failing to notice changes our thoughts and deeds. Mindfulness skills training opens up our awareness of what we fail to notice. First, here, in our thought stream, in our emotions, and in our body. And it prepares us to notice what we fail to notice in the world around us, and to become more skillful at taking in data, making sense of that data, and making informed decisions around that data. It is really that simple. This notion of equanimity, I borrow because, you know, I trained at UCLA to become a certified mindfulness trainer, and my path has brought me alongside many really wonderful Buddhist teachers, and I can't escape that. And this notion, I think, is in many faith communities, this notion of equanimity, but I borrow it primarily from the Buddhist community. And Rick Hansen is a psychologist that does a lot of work around mindfulness and trauma. This idea of unshakable balance of mind. This is how I want to describe the warrior humanitarian mind. It's this unshakable balance. This ability to step into chaos and suffering without having our own bias emerge in ways that are interruptive, disruptive, and damaging. They still exist because we're human. But to be able to regulate those, to be aware that I'm feeling uncomfortable here, I'm feeling judgment emerge here. To go into the McDonald's bathroom where there's a 19-year-old kid with a needle in his arm who's overdosed on heroin, and not to dehumanize this victim of... And if you don't think, by the way, that people suffering from drug addiction are not victims of much greater forces beyond their own decisions, I challenge you. We can have a coffee talk around that. And I'm a cop saying, there are powerful, dark forces creating addiction in this country, and some of whom have corporate titles behind their name. But that's another talk. I got to where I am because of my privilege of serving in the U.S. Coast Guard. At some senior levels, exposed to some really interesting ideas. Back up to when I was in my early 20s, I was a young Coast Guard officer in a Coast Guard cutter, Hamilton. And it was interesting because I went to Officer Candidate School, and I was one of the very few, there was only two of us in Officer Candidate School that did well enough to get assigned to a Coast Guard cutter. Because Coast Guard cutters are the territory, at least they were then, they were the territory of the Coast Guard Academy graduates. Okay? Coast Guard Academy is a primary source of Coast Guard officers. And then they let a few of us folks in that would never have gone to an academy and commission us as officers and say, okay, here's your assignment. But so I went to the Coast Guard Cutter Hamilton and had five of my colleagues from the Coast Guard Academy that we lived in what we called six-man berthing, and which is exactly what it sounds like. It's like, you know, the best summer camp ever. And one of my colleagues was a guy named Douglas Christian Johnson. And Chris and I spent many hours together on the bridge, on small boats, in Alaska, off the coast of Mexico, in the Caribbean, running Coast Guard missions, primarily search and rescue and law enforcement. And Chris and I got very close. We stayed close. Chris was one of those super smart guys. And I always knew that he wasn't a good fit in the Coast Guard. He was a Coast Guard Academy graduate, son of a, as he likes to say, son of a Missouri hog farmer. True story. And ultimately, Chris did about 7 years as an active duty Coast Guard officer, failed to promote a couple of times because he just was too much of a misfit. But he went back to school, got a second undergraduate degree in psychology, and then UCLA said, hey, dude, we want to offer you a scholarship. Come work or come to school. Get your PhD in psychology because we think you've got something to offer. Chris did. He graduated from UCLA. He went to Yale. He did postdoc work on trauma, traumatic brain injuries, began working with the VA, became a subject matter expert on trauma and human performance. Went to work briefly for the FBI. This is a funny story. Couldn't stand the organization. Quit after about 6 months, literally. And they were like, well, dude, what's your problem? This is the best job ever. And he's like, you people are idiots. And I don't say that flippantly, right? and he couldn't handle the Coast Guard. So there's no, you can't get better than the Coast Guard, by the way. And he ended up working for Naval Special Warfare in Coronado, San Diego, basically working in selection, training, and human performance of military special operators, primarily Navy SEALs, Marine Recon, Raiders, and then other services as well. And Chris and I stayed connected to the arc of our professional life, and then Chris and I started connecting around human performance, around stress and trauma. And we collaborated a little bit. I brought him up to Oregon. We did some talks around working with veterans, and I learned a great deal from him. And Chris pointed me in a lot of directions. And what I found was a lot of the mind-body interventions I learned about the military was dealing was from Chris. But the point about all of that is that there's a lot of lessons we can learn in policing from our military, and yet we often fail to do so, okay? Mindfulness has begun to embed its way into leadership in the military. General Walter Piatt currently commands, I think it's the, I want to say it's the 10th Mountain Division in Fort Collins, Colorado. He's a 3-star general. He is, he's remarkable. He's a big believer in mindfulness. He's done a number of talks about it. He's partnered with neuroscientist Amishi Jha in training, and he straight up tells his Army officers, you know, this is a part of your leadership. There's another general, John Hodney, who I just promoted to 1-star general recently, who also, you know, went to Naval War College, you can see my bias. He went to the Army War College, wrote a paper on mindfulness and leadership, and how critical mindfulness is in developing leaders in the United States Army. So they're having this conversation as though it's just another tactical discussion, strategic leadership discussion. In policing, we still see this as somehow incense burning and bald heads, although bald heads are kind of the thing. And strangely enough, I wonder how many middle-aged police officers with bald heads and big bellies kind of look like Buddha. But I don't know. So a lot to learn there. This is just an example of some things. My favorite article here, this is Chris did a really great study. I'll show you a slide that I don't fully understand, but this is a study he published in a psychiatry journal. They did some training with Marines. I'll tell you more about that in a bit. But I'm most intrigued here. So this is just a screenshot of an article by a medical doc, an Army doc, and an Army psychologist in the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Okay, so it's kind of a sexy journal, right? And these two basically conclude that, yeah, we really need to be training mindfulness in our special operations community. And they do. So this is a slide I don't fully understand. But it's a fun slide because it's kind of cool. So what Chris and his team did, large team of researchers, to include Lori Haas, who is at UC San Diego, who's a big sports performance researcher, they did brain scans of Marines, but they took Marines and 3 groups of Marines. The first group of Marines just got some sort of health intervention training. The second group of Marines got some relaxation training. And the third group of Marines got 8 weeks of mindfulness training. And then they took these Marines and put them through scenario-based trainings, much like down at Camp Pendleton, much like they go through to prepare for war, right? So the mock villages. They did 3 scenarios. The first one was mild. Second one was moderate. And the third one was a conflagration. So everything goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And then they studied them. They hooked them up to machines and brain scans. And basically what they found was, the short story is, the Marines who were trained in mindfulness recovered faster. And they had some interesting structural changes in their brain. So we see in the right anterior insula. And the insula is an interesting, it's on both hemispheres of the brain. And some of you understand this better than I do. But we see structural changes in the insula and the anterior cingulate cortex. But what these changes represent is the ability to handle interoceptive stress and downregulate it. And so what does this mean? I experience acute trauma, acute stress, and what these scans show is that mindfulness training helps me to work with that. In other words, to be better at stress and trauma. Okay. The other interesting thing about the insula is that the insula is part of our brain. It's the brain structure, one of many that we think we understand, that has a lot to do with our ability to interoceptively understand what's going on. So this notion of interoception is what's happening inside my body. How can I bring my awareness to what's happening inside my body? But also, it's deeply connected. We don't fully understand this, but it's deeply connected with our capacity to have empathy. So it's really the attunement structure in our brain, which allows us to be attuned to what's going on internally, but also for me to be attuned to what's going on with you, So it's deeply connected with our ability to be empathic, right? So as Roshi Joan Halifax says, feeling into another person is empathy, right? Feeling for another person is compassion, right? Empathy is a predecessor of compassion, right? They're distinctly different. So I just wanted to show this to you to prove that there's some really cool brain scans going on. And beyond what I just said, I have no idea what this really means. Okay, and this is a quote from the medical doc and the psychologist in the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. And in my world, you know what's interesting is that in police culture, this is what's fascinating about police culture, and I'll make this point, and if you get it, wonderful. If you don't, that's okay. We look to the military to see what the latest sexy thing is, the latest sexy weapon system. Oh, this is what they're doing. They're using this cool green laser because, you know, it makes, it makes me more badass. Okay, that's cool. But if we look at what the latest sexy thing they're doing that actually involves science and the human body, well, that's just hippie bullshit. No, actually, that's completely a failure of leadership in policing. That's what that is. I'll say that again. The greatest failure of policing in America today is the failure to look at science, to get out of our own selves, to get uncomfortable, to acknowledge our failure, and to move forward. But we don't want to do that because we're way too badass. Okay, so here's our institutional response. Typically in government, in policing, we have these kinds of responses. We have governance, let's create law. We have innovation, let's create new ways of doing things. We have science, we have collaboration, we have vulnerability and risk-taking. And so what did we do with policing in America? When Obama was in the White House, he commissioned his task force on 21st century policing. They got all of the wrong people in the room. All of the really smart people, brilliant people, but everybody who's drinking the same Kool-Aid. Because you get in the room and you're like, hey, you're pretty awesome. Yeah, I'm pretty awesome. I'm so glad we are awesome. Yeah, we're going to solve this problem. Because, you know, if you're not in this room, you're a piece of shit. You don't know nothing. And isn't it glad that we're in this room together? And then I walk over here and I'm like, can you believe she's in this room? And what is she doing here? You know? And I'm telling you, this is how it works, folks. Okay? And then you come up with all these solutions, which are awesome. And they've radically changed policing in the last 3 years. So this group got together, did all these hearings, and some really interesting, smart people spoke and misspoke, and they came up with 6 pillars, because you gotta have some really cool things. Right? You gotta have pillars. I'm not sure what a pillar is. This is what we came up with in the final report, right? Issued 3 years ago. Building trust and legitimacy, policy and oversight, technology and social media, community policing and crime reduction, training and education, officer safety and wellness. So these are kind of interesting. You'd think that here we'd really integrate some hardcore current research the military's doing, some good science. Yeah. But what we're still interested in is push-ups and sit-ups. Sorry to say. You'd think that this is 2015. This is a year after I've got really great data at Pacific University that says, hey, we got some weird shit that actually can, skills training, that can really make a difference and produce outcomes that are probably pretty helpful if you do the social math. And by social math, I mean reducing anger and aggression, reducing alcohol use, improving empathy. Social math is, well, if I'm less angry, less aggressive, that's a reduction of the asshole factor, right? That's a reduction of the reactive police officer. Huh, interesting. Nah, probably not, right? Probably not. So, it is interesting, but it's important you understand this. So when you have conversations with your senior police leaders in your community, just know this exists and use this as your superpower. Back to the troubling trifecta. We want to mask all of our problems with technology, with knowledge training. And in fact, when I get back to Hillsborough on Monday, I sit through 3 days of procedural justice training because I chose to, because I'm interested in what it is. But it's a bunch of talking to the head about procedural justice, which has some merit. But absent of really training this, it really isn't going to make a difference. So, interventions. Traditional interventions in policing, something called fair and impartial policing and procedural justice. Those are two pretty hot academic police training models that really do try to integrate social justice ideas into policing. The problem is that they're talking to the head. Let me share with you, I had a conversation with a researcher at the RAND Corporation not too long ago, and they did a study of the Navy and Marine Corps' combat operational stress reduction training. And this researcher was on the phone with him, you know, and he tells me, he's like, you know, Rich, there's really good training. You look at the curriculum, it's fantastic curriculum, good content. The problem is it didn't work. He says, the problem is, we put Marines and sailors in a room, we gave them a lot of good information, filled their head with all this knowledge, and behaviors never changed. This is what we continue to do in policing, is we talk to the head. Okay, so I can talk to the head all day and tell you about procedural justice and fair and impartial policing and equanimity and even mindfulness. But until we teach skills associated with that knowledge, behavior change is not likely to occur, and statistically hasn't occurred so far. We have personnel management issues, policies and procedures, focus on individual accountability, which is important. But again, absent is systems accountability, leadership accountability. And then, you know, this idea of dialogue without penetrating the veil of suffering. We like to stay on the surface. You know, when a police lieutenant asks a police sergeant or a police officer, how you doing? We really don't want to know the truth. Please tell me you're okay, because I don't know what to do. We don't know how to manage that. So, multidisciplinary, outside-the-box things like mindfulness, counsel practices, I'll talk to you more about what that looks like. A resiliency framework, where we're talking fitness and nutrition, preventative mental health care. Right now, we wait until you're broken, we send you to a doctor to try to fix you. That is not the appropriate response. There's all kinds of things going on there that we don't have time to talk about, but it's really important. And then mindfulness training that's scaled, and I'll talk about what that looks like with the University of California, San Diego in a little bit. Mindful leadership training. So here's the thing. I am extremely critical of leadership and policing in America, but I'm not vilifying the individual. It is a predictable consequence of a system that creates victims. And what happens, it's almost like kryptonite. That you take someone who is talented and skilled and has wonderful intention to lead, and they get into this position and suddenly they're overwhelmed. They're overwhelmed and they're not supported. It's one of the loneliest positions ever to be in a senior leadership role in a law enforcement organization. Because you've got, now your community's coming after you, and that's what it feels like, and some actually are. And your labor association's coming after you. And then you have the operational stressors and the burden of caring for people and the realization that you don't have the skills to do so adequately, right? And so the fog of war, to borrow a Clausewitz term, although it's controversial if you even ever said that. But anyway, beer discussion. It's the fog of war that these people sit in is incredibly burdensome. And so part of what mindfulness can do for policing is to train leaders how to create space in which to lead. And we've seen this work, and we know it can help. Okay? Again, it kind of goes back to the quote from Artie Lang, right? Learning the skill to see what you previously have unseen. Organizational justice is interesting. That's working with the internal stressors of how we lead and manage people. Community building and social justice. Concepts that really ought to replace this worn-out notion of community policing. And we can learn a lot from what our troops have done successfully in some areas, perhaps not, but the strategies of community building and nation building in other countries on the part of our U.S. military have been very helpful. And in fact, there's been some special operations military personnel who are reserve or National Guard folks who are also police officers who've come home from tours of duty and implemented some of those strategies they implemented in Afghanistan and Iraq and other parts of the world in their communities of high crime and been very successful. So we have a lot to learn. So I want to share with you just some of the things that are emerging. So from this tiny little effort in Hillsboro, Oregon, it started out with a funny, tall, 6'8" yoga teacher named Brant Rogers, who became a great mentor and partner. We now have this. So there's a whole lot going on. So let me just talk selfishly. This second circle up there on the top, Mindful Badge Initiative, North America work. I do I do a lot of consulting work in addition to my day job. In fact, too much consulting work. Don't talk to my wife. And I've done work in a lot of states. And just in Oregon, this is of interest because maybe there's folks that you know that might want to come to one of these. Twice a year, I do a three-day residential immersion training for first responders and military members in Bend, Oregon. Bend, Oregon Police Department has been a phenomenal leader in this arena of resilience and community building. And they've been a good partner in that. And this 2.5-day, 3-day training model is pretty intensive. So we usually do this on a weekend. So we start like on a Friday afternoon at about noon, and we train until 10 p.m. We start again at 0700 on the day 2, and we train until 10 p.m. And we start at 0700 on Sunday, and we train anywhere between noon and 4, depending upon the needs of the folks that are there. Saturday is always a long day, and when I used to do evals, I don't do them anymore because I just don't care what people think. But when I used to do evals, and I've been doing this for about 4 years, consistently was Saturday's too long, and I would simply say thank you. Thank you. Yes, it's a long day. This is not easy training. It's not intended to be. I don't want it to be easy. This is not relaxation training. You know, go have your mama bake you a pie if that's what you want, because that's not what this is. So in addition to that, I do trainings in a lot of other places. I'm part of a research team. We just wrapped up some training in West Virginia, training first responders that are basically deeply impacted by the trauma of the opioid overdose epidemic, kind of in Ground Zero, Ohio Valley, in West Virginia. And there's a lot of other training. I helped University of Texas in Dallas kind of kickstart some training down there. And so we're doing a lot of training and going up to Calgary here next month. So that's some pretty interesting stuff that's happening, continues to happen. I want to talk about, I talked briefly about Pacific University, but we've got a pending study we're looking at doing in Portland Police Bureau and Albuquerque, New Mexico. Interestingly enough, both of those police agencies are under federal consent decree from the U.S. Department of Justice. So in other words, they have failed their scorecard with the U.S. Department of Justice, and USDOJ has come in and said, yeah, y'all need to fix some things. Here's what you need to fix. Here's what you got to do, and we're going to be watching you. What we're hopeful is we can move into, there was a young woman here yesterday who asked a question about behavior, you know, are we measuring police behavior? We're going to move into mindfulness training and look at some of the outcome measures that are consistent with what U.S. Department of Justice wants to see changed. But we'll see. We're hopeful. We're not guaranteed funding for that. We should know by early next week or perhaps today, but I'm not in the real world right now. So the other thing is that's super exciting is that I'm on a training team that happens to be at UC San Diego. We just got awarded, we spent 2 years in conversation with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Office of Health Affairs, some very forward-thinking psychologists and medical docs there. We have a contract to train mindfulness to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. So we're talking Customs and Border Patrol. Pretty big deal. We're really excited about that. Imagine having that job, right? We can often imagine many of you are probably critical of some of the policies, but these are human beings in those uniforms that have to carry those policies out, right? And they are as torn often as we are about some of those policies, but, you know, it's that dissidence, that perhaps some moral injury in there that we can work with. Customs and Border Patrol, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, U.S. Secret Service, and then my favorite, the Coast Guard. And then probably some other organizations within U.S. Department of Homeland Security. So that's unprecedented and super, super exciting. The other thing I'm doing is work with Center for Counsel. And Center for Counsel is a nonprofit in Los Angeles, and for years they have been involved in training team mindfulness in counsel practice. So think Native American tradition, think Quaker tradition, other contemplative tradition that bring people together in a circle and skillfully facilitate rules around being in a circle together. Things like speak from the heart, listen to understand, listen to understand. Right? This seems a lot simple. I listen to understand. Well, often we listen to argue, don't we? Okay, I'm paying attention, so I know what to say. Rather than just listen to understand, seek to understand. It's the second principle. And I call it be pithy, right? Speak with economy, right? And those are very simple strategies or rules around counsel practice, But it's been worked, it's been delivered in LA Unified School District with tremendous success to help facilitate all kinds of conflict and help facilitate cultural evolution. And also, interestingly enough, in the California state prison system. And so my good friend now and director of the Center for Counsel, Jared Side, has spent years and years training inmates in corrections institutions in California in counsel practice with some really remarkable outcomes. And he's begun training corrections officers. That's what Jared and I have done. We met in a conference in Kalamazoo, Michigan a few years ago and wandered out into the middle of the woods and had some really great conversation around bringing together individual mindfulness practice and team mindfulness practice, which essentially is counsel practice, and bringing that in a model over a six-month period for police officers and corrections officers that could potentially be long enough to radically shift and transform in some ways, right, their ability to show up in the profession. And so we've done that. We're about ready to finish. In a couple of weeks, I go back down to LA. We finish the Bureau of Prisons work, and then a few weeks later, we finish the LAPD work. Then our goal is to take some of those LAPD officers who've been trained in counsel, trained in mindfulness, bring them together with marginalized community groups, which is another population Center for Counsel trains, and bring them together to train in mindfulness and counsel. Because now we have created people with the capacity to sit and listen with the intention to understand, rather than listen with the intention to defend. It's a powerful, powerful practice, and we're really excited to see where that's going. We're currently working with other California police agencies, like Pasadena, who's really interested in jumping into this program. It's a leadership development training program, is what it is. So it's pretty interesting. And then finally, I want to share with you this idea of a peer resilience coach. I'm a trained mindfulness facilitator, okay? It took me about 10 years to get there. Now, I'm not suggesting it takes 10 years to become a trainer, but it does take a number of years to become a trainer. So part of our dilemma right now is a lack of qualified trainers to train mindfulness to first responders. And you think, oh, it's meditation, it's easy, I can just do this. It's not. There's a huge component of understanding trauma, understanding science, and then frankly, just being skillful with resistance. Being skillful with people who look like they want to punch you in the throat is really, really hard. Okay? And so we have to train people to be able to do that. And so to oversimplify, and I'll talk about this in a little bit about the integrity of teaching mindfulness to first responders. But there are teachers, you know, there are these sort of almost spiritual teachers. In the mindfulness community, it's people like Mirabai Bush, who you all may be familiar with, even Parker Palmer, I've heard his name out there. Jack Kornfield, John Kabat-Zinn, Sharon Salzberg, you know, now mixing the Christian and Buddhist communities, okay? If there is such a thing as mixing. These are teachers. These are spiritual teachers, right? And they teach trainers. So now we have a cadre of trainers, okay? And that's the school I come from, no pun intended. Those of us, we are not teachers, but we're trainers, okay? We've been on a long journey to become a trainer. And the distance between a trainer and a first responder is it's a long distance, but there's nothing in between. And so what I've done, again, being sort of a boat rocker, no pun intended, I guess that's what the Coast Guard taught me, how to rock the boat, right? It'll self-right, just hold your breath. Is I've created something that didn't exist that I think will work very effectively, and that is a coach. So we've created a training model to bring first responders and military members to a four-month training program so that when they graduate from this training program, they are a peer coach. And they can train or coach mindfulness to their organization in certain ways with some boundaries and provide an infrastructure of training and support and leadership that currently doesn't exist. Okay? Because you can't train a trainer in 40 hours, is typically what we do in law enforcement, because it's a 40-hour work week, right? So we build training around this 40-hour model. And it would be irresponsible to do so, although it's probably being done. And I've had lots of conversations with trainers out in the United States that are doing things that are not responsible. And there's this notion, I'll address it now, there's this notion of these teachers that I mentioned, this notion of holding the integrity of the Dharma, okay? Or the integrity of mindfulness, the integrity of the science, the integrity of the intention. And it is not responsible to be ill-prepared and bring mindfulness skills training to first responders who are deeply trauma-impacted. And I sit along psychologists who are trauma experts who can fill gaps that I can't fill. And it takes training to be able to do this kind of training. And we have to train people appropriately. I've had heated conversations with people who are out there training mindfulness to first responders that have no business doing it. And it gets very, very interesting very quickly. So the peer coach model is just another path towards building an infrastructure of integrity. And we actually do our first pilot this fall. And what that model looks like, just I think it's interesting, is a three-day intensive, residential intensive. It's 12 weeks of distance learning. Myself and another couple of coaches are going to be mentors. And then another 3 days of intensive residential training. And we keep community. We hold on to that tribe. Then those folks go back to their agencies and become champions and can actually do some really good work. So we have people attending from all over the United States and Canada.
So is that voluntary or mandatory from who gets to attend?
Well, I have to approve it. So if it's not voluntary, they're not coming.
How many?
We're doing a cohort of about 15. Yeah.
That's not many.
No. And we'll do more.
Right.
But we're being very selective with who we choose for this first cohort. Because there is no other training like it. So barriers for our way ahead. And this is going to help fuel our conversation. But before we move forward, I mean, these are here and you can see them. I'm just going to ask that you take one of those sticky notes and let's do a one-word drill, okay? And I want you to close your eyes for a moment, take a nice deep breath, a nice deep exhale, and I just want you to write down the word that comes to mind. There's no right or wrong answer, there's just the word that comes to your mind. Write that down on your sticky note. And if you don't have a sticky note, I can bring you some. Simple one-word drill. All right. One word. Just one word that comes to mind. Any word. Any word. It could even be a bad word. It's me up here. All right. And if you haven't done it already, you're overthinking it, and maybe that's your word. Overthinking. Okay. Barriers for the way ahead. Access. It's really hard to get access to this community. It's really hard to get access to us, to have authentic, to cultivate authentic relationship, to cultivate authentic conversation, authentic partnership. You all know that, but I'm just going to tell you, reaffirm that for you. Funding. Funding is one of the most difficult things. You know, there are many police leaders who want to invest in things like mindfulness training, but don't have the money. Their budgets aren't built for this. This is a system problem. Budgets are built to be reactive, right? We might budget for mental health clinical intervention for police officers after some trauma. There might be some budget for that. But to think that we're going to invest relatively significant amounts of money to train preventative skills, it just isn't going to happen. And so we have to shift the mindset of our policymakers, our city and county leaders, and our state leaders, so that we understand that the return on the investment is real. You know, just as an example, Harvard did a meta-analysis 8 years ago. Okay, this is 8 years old. They looked at corporate wellness programs. What they found was in the meta-analysis of all these corporate wellness programs, not just in the United States, but internationally, they found that the average return on the investment of $1 on wellness for an employee was $3.14. Okay, now that's just looking at what you'd expect a corporation to look at. So when we look at investment in wellness of a police officer, we're really investing in their capacity to perform. So how do we measure things that don't happen? How do we measure anger and aggression and poor decision making? I don't know, okay? But my point about all that is that we could sit down with some really smart economists and figure out that there's an absolute return on investment of a dollar of mindfulness training, a dollar of preventative mental health care, a dollar of medical care, a dollar of teaching nutrition, for example.
How about in retention?
Absolutely.
Retention of officers.
Well, for sure.
Out, and then you got to train new officers.
Retention, injuries, citizen complaints, force response, community, right? Trust. If we can figure out a way to measure community trust and watch that slope grow because cops are healthy and the culture is healthy. So funding is a big issue. Leadership culture, ego, and bureaucracy. I alluded to that a little bit. I'll just let that sit for right now. Othering. We're so good at this, all of us. We're so good at in policing. It's like, well, you're just a really concerned citizen. I appreciate that. You really just don't understand. You really just don't understand. It becomes condescension and becomes divisive. So it's just a barrier. Okay, piercing the cultural veil, understanding police culture. I would encourage you all to, if you like documentaries, to look for a documentary called "Do Not Resist." And I have it on my computer. We do a late night show. I consulted with the filmmakers, a young couple from Detroit, but living in Brooklyn right now, quite successful filmmakers. This film, Do Not Resist, is I think 76 minutes of unnarrated film on their perspective of the state of police culture in America today. And it's sobering. And it's got their own bias, for sure. But it's worth watching because I think it's helpful to understand. Because much of it is, I think, plainly accurate, right? But understanding the culture, understanding that there is part of our culture that needs healing. And then I talked a little bit about the integrity and mindfulness piece. So moving ahead, ways to get ahead here. Start with awareness and compassion. Awaken to the suffering on both sides of the badge. Cultivate authentic relationships. I think that's where it all begins. You know, like in my case, inside the system, I had to work very hard to cultivate authentic relationships with people in my own organization that years later came to the dojo and trained. And to this day, many of whom still practice and find mindfulness very, very valuable. Explore strategic and tactical mediums for your voice to be heard. You know, one of the things I think that is really critically important is, you know, where can your voice be heard in hiring of police executives? And I think, I frankly think that cities in particular don't know how to hire police chiefs. I think we hire on the cultural pedigree that we've come to expect in police chiefs. Oh, I've been doing this for 25 years, therefore I've got it all figured out. And forgive me if I shared this with you all yesterday, but Coast Guard Sector Columbia River, Astoria, Oregon, historically known as Air Station Astoria. In the Aviation Operations Officer's office is this poster. And it's a poster of a aircraft, civilian aircraft, upside down, smoking on a landing strip. And under that is a quote from the National Transportation Safety Board investigator. And it said something to the effect of, the pilot's logbook indicated that this pilot had 5,000 hours flying this aircraft, period. The real question, comma, is whether this pilot had 5,000 hours flying this aircraft or 1 hour flying this aircraft flown 5,000 times. Longevity does not demonstrate competence or evolution. And in fact, in police culture, longevity often translates to regression. And you think those aren't fighting words, right? Yeah.
Say that again.
Longevity does not translate to evolution, but in law enforcement, often translates to regression. The longer I'm in the business, the more trauma, stress, politics, all those things impact me, and the more I just want to survive. I just want to make it through. And the smarter I've become at navigating the system, right? And the system demands things for me that I have a choice. I have a choice to become. Okay. A few other things. Right in the middle here, in caps, don't believe everything you think. If I could tattoo that on my arm, I would. I have other things planned for my arm, so I'm not going to do that. But it's really one of my favorite bumper stickers, my favorite slogans, and I remind myself of this often. It's really critical that we don't believe everything we think. Even as I stand before you, not to hold so dearly to things that I'm saying, because I have to be willing to be wrong, right? Cannot be bold and be right all the time. So don't believe everything you think. Teach us. Find ways to build those relationships, cultivate those relationships. We can learn from you, and also you can learn from us, right? Cultivate cultural competency. It can be done, and in different levels for different levels of engagement. But it's critical that if you have outsiders, forgive me for using that term, that want to work on the inside of law enforcement, we have to cultivate a competency to understand the culture. Hate and bias are bidirectional, right? It works both ways. There's clearly there's lots of problems in the system of policing and criminal justice in America, but to vilify the individual is not the answer. To vilify the police officer. I'm not sure if I told you this yesterday, but I was at a protest in my city not long ago. This African-American young woman was standing near me with a bullhorn, chanting, I forget what the chant was, something about me being a Nazi and oppressor. And I just thought to myself, you have no idea. You have no idea who I am. You have no idea what I think. I'm standing here in uniform, yes. But you're vilifying me simply because I'm standing here in uniform. And yet, how I see the world is that I swore to uphold your civil right to stand here and say these things to me without any kind of retribution. But in truth, I'm probably your best ally. But yet you can't see me because you can't see through your own prejudice and your own bias. Ironically, accusing me of the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the world in which we live, and this is what we've devolved to as a society in our conversations and our conflict. And there's a better way to have conflict. And I think that goes to point number one. Intelligent dialogue, multidisciplinary, critical thinking, and the best available evidence. You know, science should inform our decision-making, not dictate it. And in fact, what we think we know about mindfulness today is going to change. You know, maybe next week a study will come out and go, actually, that anterior singular thingy-mabobber, yeah, no, that's not what actually happened, right? The Marines still recovered faster, but the brain structure wasn't exactly what we thought. Yes?
Yesterday you talked about that probably in 10 years we'd see that body cam is one of the biggest mistakes
yeah.
made.
Yeah.
Could you, I don't know if this is the place, but could you elaborate
yeah.
on that?
Well, let me talk about body cameras. You know, we all think, oh, body cameras, yay, we have police accountability. Wrong. So let me explain something. The first point is this, is that the cognitive demand on the police officer is overwhelming. Body cameras add to the cognitive demand, okay? I was on a radio call with a police sergeant and another couple of officers, suicidal guy threatening his wife with a knife at an apartment complex. So I'm up on the third deck of the apartment complex, open stairs, and I'm with the sergeant, and two officers are with the spouse, and husband had fled, right? He fled with a knife, threatened her, she's cut, you know, all that sexy stuff, right? And I look down at the bottom of the stairs, I'm like, hey, Paul, I think that's our guy down there. And so the dude was down there, a knife in his hand, coming up the stairs. And sergeant races in front of me, draws his weapon, you know, is what we do, right? Goes down the stairs. The first thing he says to this guy, sir, I have to tell you that I have a body camera being recorded audio and visually. Mm-hmm. And I still have a stress response to that. And I'm thinking to myself, what are we doing to these people? That should not be his cognitive burden. We have just distracted his ability to take in data, make sense of data, and make an informed decision because of this goddamn body camera on his body and our stupid policy that's what we say to people. So that's rule number one, or reason number one. Secondly, body cameras will fail because technology fails, right? And things are rarely ever as they appear. Rarely ever. So we have people dissecting video, getting a piece of data when there's all this other data that's not available. And we're just simply going to learn, and there's going to be some tragic stories told on both sides of the badge around the failure of this technology. We're investing billions of dollars into cameras to record things, and we're investing hundreds of thousands of dollars into the health and well-being of this machine, this organic technology, right? Behavior won't change because of body cameras. If it does change, I think it'll get worse. That's my prediction. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to also say, on one hand, it seems like it's nice, easy fix for police accountability, but I come from the victim side of things. I worked with crime victims for 15 years, and the now public exposure of victims of crime is intense. So you have victims who typically often are not protected by the judicial system. Prosecution is for the state, not for the victim, and now they have one more layer of exposure that the public gets to see who that domestic violence, sexual assault, homicide co-victim was in this incredibly intrusive way. So it's an interesting paradigm. Like it's not just, oh great, we've got this tool to keep law enforcement accountable. There's all of these layers to it that are so much more complicated than the first glance. And just from the victim side of things, I get very concerned about those crime victims who now have lots of aspects of exposure. And I'm a media psychologist, so then you look at also aspects of deep faking, and you can create your own representation of that just by changing faces, and there's technology to do that. So it's really interesting, this technology piece. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think it goes back to her first point, and that is that body cameras are a reactive political solution when we are ignoring trauma. Like, I have detectives and police officers that I have to send to trauma-informed training. What do we learn? We learn how to work with children who are victims of sexual assault and physical assault, and how to work with them, how to interview them, right? In some cases, how not to interview them, okay? How to work with victims of domestic violence. How to work with, okay, understanding that their trauma, you know, start by believing is a slogan that, you know, we have, right? And so there's a lot of trauma-informed training that's very well-grounded. But is there any trauma-informed training for me, right? In other words, how do I lead and manage people in a trauma-informed landscape that simply doesn't exist, and that is a failure? And so instead of working with culture and reverse engineering the performance piece, which is what I've done, you know, I reverse engineered the police-citizen encounter and got to mind-body intervention and realized, okay, how do I improve the police-citizen encounter? That was my objective. I didn't start out like, oh, I want to take care of cops. I know that sounds terrible to say that. I started out with, how do I improve performance of the officer in a police-citizen encounter that is either routine on one end of the spectrum or violent on the other? How do I improve that? How do I improve the smiles and the violence, right? How do I do that? And how do I assure within that continuum of response that the same human machine is there? And so to work with that seems to make more sense to me than adding more technology. And the technology is, in fact, overwhelming. You put officers in a car, sit in the cockpit of a police car, call it a cockpit because it's that sophisticated, and see what's there. It's insane. Computers and radios and then study brain science, right? Just look at how distractions, you know, I'm driving down the road, and although my policy says my officers are not supposed to look at the mobile data computer in their car, it's there, it's on, of course they're going to look at it. Of course they're going to use it while driving with their knee, because that's what we do. And then it takes at least 17 seconds to refocus my attention back on the road. In 17 seconds, a lot can happen. Now let's talk about some hopeful things. Thich Nhat Hanh is an infamous peace activist, Buddhist monk. He has this famous saying among many, no mud, no lotus. And for the beautiful lotus to emerge requires some really stinky, shitty mud, right? And we've been talking about the mud today and yesterday. There is beauty that can emerge from this conversation, I really do believe in the humanity of the men and women that are on the job, but I also believe in the humanity and the goodness of all of you and the world around us. Yeah, there's evil, there's darkness. I'm pretty sure it can just go piss off, right? There's a lot of hope still, okay? Joan Halifax says that that suffering, the suffering of the mud, can feed our understanding and be one of the greatest inspirations for wisdom and compassion. And what's really interesting, you know, as I sit and listen to various conversations and Vespers and the spiritual conversations here at Holden, I'm reminded of my friends at the Zen Peacekeepers and their three tenets, which are not knowing. There's been a fair amount of conversation around not knowing here this week, in particular because of the norovirus, right? Which is the first thing that came to me as it reminded me as I was sick. I'm like, God, this reminds me of when my baby, when my oldest daughter was sick, right? I'm like, this is norovirus, right? But I'm not an epidemiologist. It's that not knowing what's going to happen, right? But also the ability to trust what emerges, right? Hard work and trust what emerges. And this notion of bearing witness, both bearing witness to joy, but also bearing witness to trauma and how to do that, right? And then compassionate action. And so what I proffer for all of you is that in some way, even if it's simple, intelligent living room conversations or coffee conversations, there is a space for compassionate action with policing in America for all of us. And again, I don't have a prescription for what that looks like. That's not my place to tell you what you should do. I don't know what you should do. But my hope is that this conversation is helpful to help illuminate some things and to challenge maybe where we sit and give us some things to think about in moving forward. Yes, ma'am.
Would you share some observations about women in roles of police leadership? Seattle has had a female police chief for some time.
Yeah.
They're looking at hiring a very popular African-American woman.
Mm-hmm. Do you know who that is?
Do you know her name?
You know
Carmen Best.
Do you know where she's from?
And
she's been in the Seattle Police
Department. She's within PD. Yeah. Okay, good.
She's 25 years.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
And Susan Marr.
Yeah, I know Susan Marr.
Okay. Yeah. She's a personal acquaintance, and she's involved in leadership training for police within the...
Yeah. Tell Sue hello. Sue doesn't like me. I'm critical of Sue. I am. I'm critical of Sue's comments at the task force on policing. She was one of the people at the table. But she's doing some good work. Okay? I will say that. She's doing some good work, but I'm critical of Sue. But let's talk, I mean, you know, women generally. I will tell you this. Women are badass warriors. End of story. That's all I have to say. Some of my greatest colleagues and greatest leaders in policing are women. Women chiefs of police. Celia Moyer, a Tempe, Arizona police chief, was critical in launching a lot of the mindfulness training that we're doing in Arizona, but also in California. Jennifer Tejada, chief of police in Emeryville, California, critical. Cynthia Renaud, who was Folsom, California's chief of police, now Santa Monica's chief of police, critical. I think that anecdotally, women leaders have been fighting a male system their whole careers, so doing bold, courageous things just comes natural. So maybe we need more women leaders. Well, there's no maybe, right? Yeah, women are badass warriors. So, and Sue is as well. But again, I think Sue may suffer from some of that longevity groupthink. She needs to go back and understand Plato's Republic a little bit better. And tell her that, she'll get pissed. So, Yeah. So we're at the end of the line for me here. And I am interested, though. Let's do one more word exercise. So please, close your eyes. Take a couple of deep breaths. When you're ready, open your eyes. Write down one word. And so the weird thing now is that I want you to share those words that you wrote. And if you're like me, you're like, I'm not sharing that. Right? Which is fine, too. You can pass. But I'm very curious what those two words are. I often do this at the very end of a training to see what's emerging for people internally. And I usually get a little more prompt and stuff. But you all are really smart folks. You don't need prompts. But it's really insightful to see what's emerging in the room. And so if you would tolerate me, I'm going to move around the room and ask you to share both of your words. And you could share, and I might repeat them so people can hear because I have a mic. And if you don't want to, just say pass. It's fine. No judgment.
It doesn't work.
Ah.
Here, try this one.
So can we start over here?
Sure. My first one was Blaze because he's a guy who I run with who's a cop.
Okay.
And I was thinking about him a lot.
Okay.
And then my last one was Act. Just feeling like...
Okay. Befriend police officer and act. Thank you. Let us go this way.
My first one was need, because I think of the need for this in my community.
Can't hear over here.
I'll repeat. So the first word was need.
Need. And the second was, is not valid because I was thinking you said one, and so one was my wordy. I think that's why.
Okay. So second, we're not sure. Sir.
Preparedness.
Preparedness.
And no link at all, Lotus.
Notice.
Lotus.
Lotus. Okay, great. So what'll help us to move through quickly, just say your words. No explanations needed. We just, brevity here.
Heat.
Heat.
Breeze.
Breeze. Thank you.
Options.
Options.
Hope.
Hope. Thank you.
Peace. Hope.
Peace. Hope. Thank you.
Hope. Discipleship.
Hope. Discipleship. Thank you.
Vulnerability.
Vulnerability.
Growth.
Growth. Thank you.
Effective Alley.
Effective Alley.
Alley is the name of our daughter.
Our daughter.
Okay. I'll ask you about that later.
Okay. Conflict.
Conflict.
Hope.
Hope. Thank you.
Control and happiness.
Control, happiness. Thank you.
Eagle, participate.
First word again?
Eagle.
Eagle?
Eagle.
Ego. Thank you. Yeah, see, hearing problems, too many guns. Ego. Participate. Thank you.
Trust. Distrust.
Trust. Distrust. Thank
mistrust.
You.
Notice.
Mistrust.
Mistrust. Notice.
Notice. Thank you.
Peace. Hopefulness.
Peace. Hopefulness.
Ego. Empathy.
Ego. Empathy.
Bridge. Smoke.
Bridge. Smoke.
Pass.
Sir, how about up front here, please?
Calmness and stress.
Calmness, stress.
Flexibility, peaceful.
Flexibility, peaceful.
Mindfulness, badass.
Mindfulness, badass. One of my favorite words. Sir.
Inhale, wind.
Inhale, wind.
Police, eyes.
Police, eyes. Thank you.
Calm, hope.
Calm, hope. Thank you.
Crime, source.
Crime, source. Thank you. Sir.
Evidence, hope.
Evidence, hope. In the back here.
Run and compassion.
Run, compassion. Thank you.
Ego and messaging.
Ego, messaging. Thank you.
Peace and cherish.
Peace and cherish.
Yeah. Hope, people.
Hope. People, thank you.
Hope, empathy.
Hope, empathy, thank you.
Lamaze breathing, wind.
Lamaze breathing, wind, thank you.
Culture and chaos.
Culture, chaos, thank you.
Love, open.
Love, open, thank you.
Intervene, hope.
Intervene, hope, thank you. And for those of you in the loft, you're not getting away.
Hope.
Hope.
Instead of one, hope.
Hope, thank you.
Life and hope.
Life and hope. Thank you.
Peacefulness, mindfulness.
Peacefulness, mindfulness. Thank you.
Beloved, refuge.
Beloved, refuge. An artist in the room. Thank you.
Yes. Join late, so harmony.
Harmony. Thank you. Okay. Happy to answer questions, to create some more conversation. I'm here all week, as they say. Any questions right now?
Would you mind defining mindfulness for us one more time?
Yeah. My operational definition of mindfulness is paying attention on purpose without judgment and without emotional narrative.
Emotional narrative?
Emotional narrative. you know, we all have this thinking mind, right? And a thinking mind just starts, it works all the time. Scientists tell us we have 90,000 some independent thoughts every day, right? So our mind is constantly working. And this notion that we can turn it off is completely foolish, absent of some really good drugs, medically prescribed appropriately. But, you know, so to think that meditation is turning the mind off is the incorrect. It's incorrect. So what we're doing is we're working with this thinking mind, right? And we're bringing our attention to something that we're focusing on, the what's really in the space, rather than what we think is in the space, what we expect to see in the space, what our experience has taught us is in the space. All those things are contributing factors to our sense-making, but to have the greatest possible clarity of being where we are, with all of our senses, without our own judgment emerging in ways that is overwhelming, where the tail of our judgment becomes the tail that wags the dog, and without narrating our own explanation of what's happening. We do this, right? Oh, I know what this person's thinking. I know why they're in the room. And then we start telling a story. Yes, sir?
To encapsulate, the thing is, I'm sure a lot of us have friends or relatives that are in the police force, and to bring some of this to them, is there a website other than mindfulness.com? Is there some place we can go that would, you know, sort of encapsulate what you've been going through?
I wish I could tell you, go to the U.S. Department of Justice website. But I got to tell you, go to mindfulbadge.com. That's one of the selfish reasons I gave you notebooks and really cool stickers, which have my website on them. That, I mean...
I don't have your...
I'll get you a sticker. Don't go anywhere. I didn't get those made for nothing. I want to share something with you. So I get these texts periodically. I get these texts from people I've trained, who many of whom have become really good friends. And I want to share a story. There's a guy named John, and he'll be okay with me sharing this. There's a guy named John Vong. John is a badass. He's a former Coast Guard officer who set up a number of specialized law enforcement teams after 9/11. I'm looking for a photo, so I'm not texting anyone. And John subsequently became a law enforcement ranger with the National Park Service. He served in Mount Rainier for a number of years. He got really burned out of doing mountain search and rescue, and one of his good friends was shot and killed on a remote mountain road about 4 years ago, law enforcement ranger. He was on the manhunt for that. And anyway, just long story, he's been through just a hell of a lot of trauma. And I've trained with him, and he occasionally sends me text messages that are just so encouraging. And this is representative of the men and women in policing. So not long ago, he sends me a text, says, "Hey Rich, my coworkers and I de-escalated a suicidal subject today. Got him to professional care services. No cuffs, no use of force, just solid people and good de-escalation skills. Good." I said, "I'm good, but I'm emotionally drained." I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we get. You know, then another one days later. We had a difficult call with county about 10 days ago. A 16-year-old girl hung herself from a tree a mile west of our district. That was unfortunate and sad. I've been deep into my yoga and meditation practices. And he goes on to talk about that. But these are the things that men and women in this business are experiencing. Right? And to have a place where they have a mind-body intervention to go to process the trauma, is critical. I talked about Robert Sapolsky's book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and let me oversimplify that for you, and I'm sure he'd probably critique this, but I'm going to say it anyway. He talks about zebras. So zebras are on the plains, and they're eating grass. And a really alert zebra says, "Hey, zebra friends, there's a lion that's going to come eat us." And the zebra friends say, "Well, let's get the hell out of here." And zebra friends run, right? And maybe all the zebras get away. Maybe they don't. Maybe one falls, you know, and becomes food. But when the zebras are done running, they stop. They assess. Okay, we're safe. And they violently shake their bodies. What they're doing is processing the neurochemical dump of their stress response. Okay? Now, we're not zebras. I think maybe one or two cops I've met actually may be zebras. But we're not zebras, okay? However, there's some similarities to the stress response. What do we do? I'll give you an example. A friend of mine's brother is a Portland Police Bureau police officer, and a couple of years ago, there was a story in the Oregonian that resonates with me. So they write a story about how he and his partner went to the fifth story of this building in downtown Portland, and woman standing at the ledge getting ready to jump, right? And so somehow they end up rescuing her. But by rescuing her, I mean each of them grabs her arm as she's falling. So they're like this, classic, you know, Hollywood picture. Each one of them is holding the arm of this woman, right? For however many minutes until the real heroes, the firefighters, come, right? Yeah, and rescue her with their ladder. Then the story goes on, and then the officers walk down to the first floor, get in their calls, and go to the next radio call. This is what we do. We go to the domestic violence call, we go to the bar fight, we go to the child abuse, we go to the dead body call, we go to the gang fight, one after the other, after the other, after the other, with no institutional break, no rhythm, no skills of how to work with that, no interruption, which could be as simple as a short walk, a skillful breathing practice that downregulates the sympathetic nervous system, activates the parasympathetic nervous system, simple breathing. Simple things we could do, we could teach police officers to do that would have long-term significant impacts on their health and well-being and immediate impacts on their ability for cognitive agility, working memory, empathy, compassion. We don't do that because we're badass. We don't need that. That's bullshit. Yeah. Interesting stuff, right? So, question over here.
Well, two things. Why don't we get some more of that from the media? That, you know, all those things that you just said in the last response. I mean, that needs to be educated.
We're beginning to get.
The public,
yeah,
because
yeah,
we need to be more mindful of that. Yeah. That you're just doing that bam, 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 bam every day,
right,
and not even in between times on that day, but then the next day and the next day. And the other question is, was interesting the words that you had us write down. But what was the purpose of that? Was that for you or for us, or what was it doing?
Yes.
I don't know.
Tell me what struck you about those words?
I thought it was interesting that from other people and the duplication of different words.
Well, you know, I think that a group practice like that is it eliminates what we're thinking, right? Because had you not shared those words, none of you would know how the other responded to that prompt. And I think that's how we build community, right? We build community by having some level of vulnerability to say, oh, these are my two words, they're dumb, but I'm going to read them, right? That's what you're thinking, and that's okay. But it's part of building community. And to the media is getting a lot more savvy. I do a lot of work with the media, and I'm hopeful maybe this weekend, if you're not here, there might be a piece on NBC Nightly News about our work in LA. Maria Shriver did a piece a year ago for Today Show, which I think was amazing. She's so gifted. She's such an amazing human being. And one of the smartest journalists I've ever met, asked really intelligent questions, very, very, very well informed. But the media is asking good questions now, and there's still some journalists who just want to rake shit, and they do, and they do it very well. But you know, what's interesting is when I talk to media, they're like, dude, we really need this training. And in fact, I'm training a bunch of TV journalists in September in Portland because of that very issue. A reporter came out and did a story, and she's like, oh, we really need this training. And I said, yeah, I know you do. Because why? Because trauma is trauma.
Well, we all need it. I mean, we all have traumas,
yeah,
too.
Totally, so. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
I'm a retired educator from a community that did community policing. And every noon, well, not every noon, but many noon hours, part of the police beat would be to come to our school and be there in the lunch cafeteria with the students. And I always felt that was an extremely effective way to sow seeds of good relationship. I remember one instance when the police person who came brought a birthday cake for an underprivileged child who would frequently engage in conversations with that police person. And I always felt that that just really established some positive feelings of community from both sides, from the kids and from the police people.
Yeah, I don't
know. Is that quite a common police practice to
do? I think so. I think we're seeing that a lot. But you know, the capacity for that officer to really authentically connect with people is really, it's what's their baseline, right? And I'm not here to talk about police practices and community policing. I mean, all those things I think are helpful, but none of those matter until we start leading our police organizations in ways that are informed by trauma. And so that's kind of a separate discussion around strategies and community policing, which I think are probably just fine. Yes?
I've learned a lot by your presentations. I am curious, however, how you found Holden or Holden found you.
Very good friends. Rebecca and Corey Nevers have been coming here for years, and last year they drove us here. And so, and I sat, to be honest, I sat here last year and I thought, it's a really interesting, smart, powerful group of white people. And I really want to get their audience. Because here's the truth, folks. And now the tough part of the conversation is I think that middle-class white folk, upper-middle-class white folk, often see policing and want to rally and say, hey, yeah, good job, thank you for your service. And I think that's wonderful, but let's look beneath that. You know, let's really, let's look into the mud, right, and help to create the lotus. Because I think that there are ways that the faith community from which you all come, and maybe it's predominantly Lutheran, maybe it's not, but there's a role for your faith community in this conversation.
And our own mind pools.
Of course, yes, of course, yeah. So that hopefully answers your question.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes?
I'm not sure if this is going to come out well, but you just said some words that have been bouncing around in my head. And I said, here I am. I am this upper middle class white old lady, and my view of what I came to this because my practice at Holden is to go to everything and see whether something hits. And mm-hmm. But I was expecting to hate this class. Mm-hmm. I
hope you hate it.
Well, I don't though. But when I think of police, I have a positive negative connotation. I believe that the police are there to help us and make things better. But I also have some sense of, I'm not proud of this necessarily, but police people are not people like me in some sense. They're something other. And I'm not quite sure in what sense. But I don't have any connection with anybody who is a police officer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to think that that's not necessarily good. Now, are you going to get it? You're doing a tomorrow thing, right?
I'm doing like a coffee talk, I think, tomorrow. I'm not doing any other talks.
So, you know, what are you, I hear you saying what needs to happen with police. It makes great sense. What needs to happen with us upper middle class?
Well, I was hoping you would tell me. Yeah, I don't know.
To make more relationship.
You know, I think pay attention. Pay attention, awareness and compassion. Right? Pay attention, trust what emerges. You have a lot of wisdom that you've lived in your life. And you know better than I do when you go back to your community how to have conversation. And you know, I don't know that it's a good or bad thing about your relationship with police. You know, do you know any? I don't know that that's important that you have close relationships. For some of you, it may be. And cultivate those, but it may not be. Yeah. It may be just, again, it may be part of democracy is how we have conversation around issues that are difficult. And so maybe read your daily news feed with a slightly different lens than you do currently. But you know, I will tell you this, and I am a voracious defender of the men and women who wear the uniform of policing. I am. And it's for them that I do this work. Because I'll tell you what, it'd be so much easier to be in the system, to fly that 1 hour 5,000 times, you know, to rise the ranks, to have sexy job titles. But the men and women in this business deserve better than that. right? And so what does it mean when you go to your communities? I don't know. I really don't know. You know, I've had conversations with lawmakers, and I think lawmakers need to hear your voice. And police chiefs need to hear your voice, whether it's in Seattle about hiring women. What's really interesting is Seattle PD just hired a consultant who's a former chief of Pittsburgh PD who was recently in conversation with me around mindfulness. And a really interesting guy. He comes from Madison, Wisconsin, which is one of those epicenters of weirdness, okay? And I say that with deep affection. Any Madison people here? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, but they're really trying to do some things that are forward-thinking, right? And so support them in any way you can. And if you're from Madison, support them in any way you can. If you're from Minneapolis, St. Paul, listen to understand, because there's some deep, deep problems in policing in Minneapolis right now, and in many communities. Yes?
You know, I want to say, in response to what she just said about not knowing anyone involved, but to have a daughter, you know, going through
something. Is this Allie?
Huh?
Is this Allie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is she a police officer?
She's in administration in ICE.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for being here.
So, I feel mildly traumatized myself, knowing...
Just sitting in
things,
here?
Sitting here, yeah. Listening,
yeah.
To things that I didn't know about her, but relates to changes that I can see in her life, in the distance between us that wasn't there.
Yeah. Where's she at?
Tacoma,
okay. Yeah. Send this to her. My sticker info's in there. And tell her you met some weirdo who is working
with... No, I'm going to say badass.
Okay, who's working with DHS, but she'll have access to this training at some point. Sir?
I'm curious, what is the retention of a new officer coming on board?
There's no good data. I don't know. It's different everywhere you go. I'm not really sure. In my region, most cops, when they come on board, what's the retention? Most cops, and the data's changing. So most cops will get weeded out during their first couple of years because it's a tough job. Often what happens is these really bright, bushy-tailed people, I really want to do that. I want to help people. And then, you know, they go to their 15th child abuse call. They're like, oh, my God, I hate this. And then and if they're really smart, they quit. They're really smart, they quit. They go do something else. So it's, you know, but... Yeah, I make it sound so terrible. There was another question in the back here somewhere?
Well, just a comment. The feds or the state governments come up with some money and they go out and hire 50 or 30 or 20. But we never read about mindfulness training. They aren't funding that program because it's either not announced or it's not popular.
Well, they're not.
We have great safety. Yeah. And numbers of more police on the
right. Street. Well, they're not funding it. One. What's really interesting is the Menlo Park Police. At the time, the chief of police, Robert Johnson, came from LA County Sheriff's Department. He trained their whole agency. So I trained his entire agency in the 3-day residential training. I just wrapped that up in April of this year. San Bruno, California, which is just south of San Francisco. If you remember, I think 4 or 5 years ago, they had a big pipeline eruption issue there. And whoever owns the pipeline, I forget what organization, what company, they dumped millions of dollars into a fund. And part of that is remediation, much like we're doing with the mine here, remediation for resilience for the community. And part of that, they pulled a big pot of money out to train their entire agency. And we're doing 2 different 3-day retreat sessions. So it gets funding, but the funding is, it's non-intentional funding. In other words, it's not budgeted funding. It's, it's Facebook is willing to fund Menlo Park. Great, thank you. It's, you know, PGE or whatever is willing to fund San Bruno. So part of our issue is funding, because government agencies are not going to fund training. It's a challenge, you know. I'll spend, literally, if I hire a new SWAT guy on my SWAT team, easy, 10 grand just to kit him up. $10,000 just to get them the minimum amount of gear necessary. But my peer coach training cost about $5,000, 4 months of training. And I have police chiefs going, I don't know if I want to spend $5,000 on yoga. You know? So.
It might be too early to tell, but is resistance lessening because mindfulness is getting so much more press?
Yep, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And with that in mind, though, I think that's where the beauty of all of you is that at as you also normalize it with your skills, experience, contacts, I think that's very helpful, just keeping it in the vernacular. And as then community members saying, hey, this is very effective, just being able to share that. That really does make headway. Just normalizing that this is a strategy, and there's services that help reinforce the strategy, and what are we doing in our community about it?
So I want to say thank you for being here. Feel free to leave. I'm happy to stick around, but don't feel obligated to stay. Appreciate you being here this long. And, yeah.